everyone, and welcome to another episode of Wisdom Chat. And this is a rather unusual episode. I just felt that it would be nice to do something that was kind of out of the norm in terms of the subject matter we tend to cover on Wisdom Chat, which is anything to do with money and well-being. And I've got my very good friend, Alan Reynolds, with me today. And Alan is an author, and I'll let him tell you a little bit about that side. But Alan, it's lovely to have you on board. I know from work, you've got a sort of HR training background. Tell us a little bit about your background in terms of work.
Thanks, Phil. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me on. Yes, I left school at 18, joined Lloyds Bank, worked my way through the management training program. I was my first taste, interestingly, of training came my first sort of junior management role when I was appointed down at the training centre down in Hindhead in Surrey, where I was in charge of an assessment course. And that was totally different to what I've been used to. I mean, I've been trained in the traditional banking progression. So that gave me a totally different sort of view of life and management specifically. Then I became a sub-manager at one of the Birmingham branches, and that was a bit grim, but I managed to survive. then I got transferred. My first managerial appointment was up in Sheffield. And then from there, I moved up into HR in, when was it, 1987. So I became an HR manager and stayed there. You know, I just enjoyed it. It fitted my skill set completely. And I stayed there, became senior HR manager. I was area personnel manager, or area HR manager as it became. And I stayed there till 2001, when they offered me early retirement, and I said thank you very much. And I set up a consultancy, and within 6 weeks, here's an irony, within 6 weeks I was working back for the bank as a consultant. It was brilliant. So there was a certain irony there, but I continued. That was interesting because I moved into doing project work. Then I became project manager. Then I became an interim manager. I worked for Centrica, and so I had to do the helicopters and the survival course, which was amazing. After banking, stood on the deck of a gas rig waiting for the helicopter land so you can get home was something, almost bizarre.
So when you did the training, to interrupt here, Alan.
No, it's fine.
The survival training. So I've seen sort of various documentaries on some of the training that people have to go through in terms of safety, survival, and so on. Yes. And one of those is where you have to, it's not a simulation, you're in a pool, in a helicopter that then capsizes, and you've got to escape out of it.
Well, interestingly, the instructor said, if you survive, you've passed, which was a bit disconcerting, hence the name survival course. That's where I think the name comes from. But anyway, you've got these things they call rebreathers, which is, it looks like a flat bag that you have here, but you can actually, because when you breathe out, you there's still oxygen within your breath as you breathe out, you can use that. So you've got one of these things on and the kit, as though you would crash in a helicopter. And it's about 20 feet deep, this pool, and tip it down, but then it rotates and you're totally disorientated. But what you're trained to do is hold to the window. And when it stops, the window is the exit. So you can then swim out and upwards. It's not something you want to do on a daily basis, but having achieved that, it was really good.
Yeah, so. It reminds me of I did two parachute jumps, and the first jump I did, I had to go through a full day's training, and I just remember feeling quite nervous going through the training, and then the very end of the course, before we were due to go off in the aeroplane,
Yes.
was all the disasters that can go wrong and what you do to actually
Yes.
correct it.
Yeah.
And so you go through all this before you get in the plane and go up. And I'm just thinking what it must have felt like prior to getting into that sort of helicopter in that pool,
Yes. Yeah.
and then going through that motion like a washing machine
Yeah,
to disorientate you.
just like that. Here's a question for you. You might.
Yeah.
What is the second thing that you do when entering a life raft? So here we got this life raft, and
Yes.
you've got to imagine it's the North Sea.
Yeah.
The water in the pool was a bit warmer, but anyway, got dragged onto this thing, and the guy said, "What's the second thing that you do when you get into a life raft?" And nobody knew.
No.
They hand out the seasick tablets.
Really?
Yeah, the first thing you do is a roll call.
Right. Yes, I
The
understand
second thing you
that.
do is hand out the seasick tablets because the life rafts, they roll.
Yes. Oh, no, that's that. Yeah. No, I understand that,
Yeah.
particularly if you're in some of the seas around the oil platforms and don't
Exactly
tend to
that.
be
Yeah.
calm, do they?
That's a great quiz question, by the way.
Wow. Wow.
And
So,
funny enough, the
yeah.
my experience there, a lot of that, if you remember the sixth pillar at the end with the gas rigs, that was all based on that particular episode. So all the time I've been doing and having these experiences from training,
Yeah.
parts of it has landed in my head and it's
Yeah.
come out in a story.
And that's a great segue into your writing because, correct me if I'm wrong, you started writing more out of sort of a hobby.
Well, it was strange. It in 2010, I mean, you recognize this. I've got nothing. January 2010, after Christmas, I've got nothing in my diary,
Yeah.
and I got this idea in my head because there was a the story came probably 10 years earlier, about 95, 96, something like that. And I was up in Newcastle doing some work with a buddy of mine, and we went out for dinner that evening. I was staying in a hotel, and on the way back to the hotel, he pointed out those two huge tower blocks in Gateshead, and he
Yeah.
related the story to me, which hung in my mind. I was thinking, what on earth, how on earth could that have happened? So it was that triggered this idea of a story. So I was trying to write the narrative of what could have happened in the event,
Yes.
which was a true story. And
Yes. Yeah.
from there, I started doing some research, which became around the Kosovan War, Kosovan refugees,
Yeah.
and then that book became Flying with Kites. And I mean, that took me just over 3 weeks to write.
Wow.
The first draft I'd completed within 3 weeks, which was just an amazing experience.
Yeah. I must say that was the first book I read of yours, Flying with Kites, and from the get-go, it just had me riveted. And but it's interesting. So I've read probably about 14 of your novels now, of the 16 that you've had published.
Thank you.
And yeah, and the thing that really struck me was some of the subject matter that you picked throughout all your novels. So obviously there we've got the sort of the ethnic war between the what was it the Serbs and the
Serbs
Croats,
and Kosovans, yes.
Kosovans, yeah, and so it gives a really stark insight into the harrowing journey that an individual went through to escape that conflict.
Well, it's given me a greater insight into refugees.
Yeah.
Before I wrote that, I didn't really have any connection with refugees. I mean, since then, I did get contacted by somebody from the Kosovan community in London, and I went down to meet them. And from there, I learned so much more. They're wonderful, wonderful people, doing very, very well. Got their own businesses and really achieving and adding to society and particularly around London. They're just wonderful people.
I mean, it was one of those novels that just kept me riveted, really, and so it didn't take me too long to finish it. But going back to that sort of the subject matter, so that was the sort of the refugees, the ethnic conflict, and what causes people to sort of flee and to find refuge in other countries. But you've written a lot of different subjects. So you talked about your time in the banking world, and that was put to good use in Breaking the Bank.
Yes, I have to be careful of saying that that wasn't totally an autobiographical event, but I shall say no more. But one of the things I wanted to get over on that, it was set in 1997, which was really it come to the end of my time in the bank. But for me, it had shown the changes in banking. I'd come up the very traditional way when it was all about customer relationship and so on. When here, this time, it was all about sales and target driven. What it did do is make me reflect on some of the management styles that I had, and I've replicated those within the book. So you've got this branch manager, Martin, and he's being harassed by his regional director. And all of these kind of interactions were based on real events. And some of the things I'd witnessed, some of the things were hearsay of what other managers had witnessed. The managers' meeting, the monthly managers' meeting, was just something to behold. And if I was, when I train managers, I talk about ethical management. This is what it wasn't. It was totally unethical. It was bullying at the highest end. That was all going on at that time, and that's reflected in there, and it's reflected in the behaviors of how the branch manager in this case actually worked on a day-to-day basis.
You can well imagine, though. I mean, like you say, so this character Martin is himself under enormous pressure from above to perform. And interestingly, how then it incites certain behavior that then is reflected in others down the line. And it's interesting. I just remember you talking about banking. I mean, I come from a financial background for many years, and so I've worked alongside banks and the British Banking Association. And I must admit, and it wasn't a prejudice or anything, I just felt that some of the behavior at the time was wholly inappropriate, and it caused a tremendous amount of suffering. And I myself have been on the receiving end of that many, many years ago with one particular high street bank. And so seeing how that industry has evolved has got to a stage where it was. Oh, you almost felt like they were worse than used car salesmen. But how all that has begun to change. And so I have to remind people who I train around finances, banks are businesses, and they're in business to make money like any other business. So don't see it as a public service. And
No.
many people do.
Yeah.
So from a
Yeah. Yeah.
consumer point of view,
Yeah.
they see the
Yeah.
banking industry as very much a public service, and I have a right to this, when in actual fact, that's not the case. But equally at the same time, the changes that have gone on in the banking industry to address some of these issues that we.
It really needed to, Phil. It really needed to, because you'll see there that a lot of it is about mis-selling, because the drive was against targets. I mean, I was sacking financial advisors, for forging signatures.
Right.
on customer signatures. And they were nice people. They just did it because they were under pressure to conclude a sale.
Yeah.
And it was dreadful. It really was. So
Yeah.
this is the thing about behaviors driving behaviors.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I it just reminds me of a story that it involved my wife. She spent many years working in the pharma industry in sales.
Yes.
And it was very much, numbers driven. And even when the circumstances were changing, say, for example, doctor surgeries weren't seeing reps anymore, yet the pressure brought to bear on the reps to go and see doctors was
Yes.
becoming even more immense.
Yes.
And so then individuals would then just make numbers up.
Yeah.
And it's interesting,
Yeah.
you're right about, how that sort of forges that behavior that's
Yes.
coming out. And I suppose those kind of behaviors can happen in any aspect of society anyway.
Yes.
But that book, because you've got a number of characters in there, and there's lots of like subplots and sub stories going on,
Yes.
each with their own sort of motive for why they're doing what they're doing. And I love the way that you kind of weave it all together. And it's as you're going along, you start to see how one behavior of one person then impacts another,
Yeah.
and that knock-on effect. And it's what makes the story so riveting.
Thank you, yes.
Yeah. So I'm just thinking in terms of some of the others. So you've got the experience of the banking industry, but I'm just thinking of the Valley of the Serpents.
Yes.
So that's set in Australia. It's set on Aboriginal protected land,
Yes.
and it's involving corporate. Is it like a oil company or something?
Yes. Well, basically, the idea to start with, and this is going back, I wanted to do a disaster movie,
Ah, right.
or write a disaster book, I should say. And I got
Yeah.
this idea of, what hasn't been done yet. And I like this idea. This was before those lads got trapped in the cave.
Yes.
But I like the idea of this cave and these three graduates doing their geology course and getting. Going through all that trauma. So, writing that in the sort of the first couple
Yeah.
of chapters, it gave quite a bit of input, and people started thinking, what happened to the three geology students?
Yeah.
The key one was Harry, the lad, because he was one of these daredevil type of characters, try anything. And it changed him in a way. He became even more of himself. He gets hired by this company as a geologist, which is based in Switzerland. But the more I started thinking and working about this company, they weren't what they seemed.
Yes, you get
And
that right from the opening chapter. You get that. You're thinking something's afoot here. And
yes.
so in that cave, there's an incident, and it's life and death basically.
Yes. Yeah.
And
Yeah.
yeah.
And you can imagine, having come out of that, he's a different person. But going forward, and then he suddenly finds himself that he's been accepted by this particular company, very secretive,
Yeah.
very protective of its own environment, very, very wealthy. But it's driven again by this entrepreneurial type of character who is very ruthless. On the face of it, he seems very eco-friendly, but behind it lies a lot of murky water.
Yes. Yes.
So I got the picture of the organization and what they're trying to do. And then he's, as you rightly say, he's sent out to Australia to find uranium. And I learned a lot about the uranium industry in Australia.
Right.
And
Ah.
that was fascinating, particularly with the relationship with the Aboriginal community. because I didn't know this. They get 6% of the royalties from, there's a very big one in the Kakadu National Park, and they get 6% of the royalties from that. So that's pretty well, that was a sweetener, of course. But
It's I what I found interesting was so you've got this sort of career history and the experiences that you have, both in terms of the banking industry, HR training, but also the oil industry, having even been on oil rigs and so on. And so I can see how in some of these stories how you bring that to bear on the story. However, there's so we've got we're talking about the Valley of the Serpent and the involvement, and there's quite a bit to do with Australia. And I thought, wow, so it's then when I was talking to you before about your research and the depth of research that you do, and it reminded me of another author, Ian Rankin, who I learned oftentimes will actually go to places to so that he can get his facts right about those places. And so
He
people
has
will.
more money than I have.
Yes. So you didn't exactly go.
I have to rely on Google Earth.
I was just thinking, getting out to Australia and getting out into the, was it the Kruger Park or
Kakadu Park,
Kruger Park?
Kakadu National Park. That was where Crocodile Dundee was filmed there. At the end, when the credits come up, it says "with thanks to." But it also contains my favourite character, probably in all my books, was Nate, the guy who was in charge of the unit there. But
He's a kind of almost like sometimes the inept one, but quite very quick thinking on his feet.
Oh yeah, but I love his Australian humour.
Yes,
Brilliant.
definitely, definitely. I was thinking then, so going back to the flying with kites and the Kosovans and what was going on there. Tell us a bit about the research you did there and where did it lead for you? Who did you meet in all of this?
Well, when I started looking up instances about the Kosovan War, I needed to understand a little bit more. There was a lot of information. In fact, I got on some of the old archive BBC websites, and there was an interview with Ravi Omar, the presenter, news reader, and he was actually on the bus that was taking refugees from the departure lounge to the aircraft, and he was doing a piece to camera on there, and they were showing pictures of the refugees, so I was able to get a really good picture of it. And the actual journey that Katya takes from with Skopje at that time, Macedonia, to Leeds Bradford, that's all accurate, even down to the fact that it was a chartered flight from the Bulgarian airlines. And it landed at 3:25 in the afternoon on a Sunday, and there was a huge mob waiting for them with cameras and so on, frightened them to death, frightened
Oh
them to
yeah, I'm sure. But
death.
when you actually when you follow the journey of Katia,
Yes.
I mean that in itself is frightening.
Yes, it was. And again, that I did use Google Earth, and the journey through the forest is accurate, or as accurate as it could be. And where she got found through the villages, that was all accurate. It was horrific. And the coach journey from Pesh to the camp, that was accurate. And they got these old coaches that they were using, they were battered around. They didn't have really good transportation, and the roads were bad too. So it was quite traumatic. I think when I went back to and actually started meeting some of the Kosovan refugees, they were very grateful for the exposure about it. One woman said to me, "I've got a copy that I'm going to give to my lad when he's 14,"
Wow,
to,
wow.
to try and explain what it was really
Yeah,
like.
yeah.
But there was a sort of postscript here, because just by accident, I got a training work actually in Pristina, the capital. And when I was going out there, they gave me some contact points, and I was able to contact some local Kosovans, had a coffee, and they were explaining to me their experiences, what happened to them when they had stayed behind. Some were in
Yeah.
hiding for, several months.
Yeah.
It
Yeah.
was a really dreadful time.
All we got at that time was what we were being fed via, the media,
Of
the
course,
news
yes,
channels.
yeah.
And so you really didn't, that news channels, they like to sort of focus in on, some of the most harrowing things. But actually, even when they focused in on it, you really didn't
No,
fully
because you lose the
understand.
context, and
Yeah.
this is the issue that you have. When I actually was able to get on some of the war crimes tribunal, that you can access the witness statements, and I was actually reading some of those, which were absolutely harrowing.
Yeah. Yeah.
The behavior of the soldiers,
Yeah, yeah.
it was horrific.
I think I mean, obviously we've seen it throughout history, haven't we? Where one nation is trying to rout another
We've
nation,
got
and
it now in Ukraine. You
yeah.
know, it really is. It's like a mirror image.
Yeah. And it's you do wonder, what is it that goes through minds of ordinary people who were like teachers or factory workers,
Yes,
or
yeah.
and all of a sudden, they take on a completely different persona and behave in
Yes.
a manner that's very sort of almost like animalistic. And you think,
It's a
what
good
is it?
word. It is, yes, because it sort of drills down to basic, I'd like to say human behaviors, but it's right, it is sort of animal survival behavior, but it is quite, it's quite horrific.
Now, just taking a little bit of a twist,
Yes.
because and our listeners can can take a look for themselves. There's a whole raft of novels that cover everything from environmental disaster, Trent Island.
Yes.
You've got your ethnic conflicts, so the flying with kite. You've got the issue, the environmental and cultural issue with Valley of the Serpents.
Yes.
The financial issues of breaking the bank, so even just those few, and there's more besides that you cover, because you cover things like terrorism and
Yeah.
sleeper cells and the impact that some of those things could have. However, Pendle Cottage,
Yes.
very, very different. Tell us a bit about Pendle Cottage.
Well, I wanted to do something different. I'd finished my trilogy, the First World War trilogy, and I wanted a break from historical writing. And I had this idea that wouldn't it be good if I could do a supernatural one? But I didn't want a sort of Stephen King. It wasn't that sort of ilk that I had in mind. I wanted it to be, I wonder if, that sort of feel to it, rather than being totally unbelievable or ridiculous. I wanted, I'd wanted to trigger that part of the mind where there was a degree of uncertainty. Do spirits exist? And I was triggering that sort of emotion within the book. So the start was a very straightforward pretext that you've got quite wealthy family, well-to-do. He's a barrister, she's a physiotherapist, two precocious kids. They're in the family Volvo, driving along the motorway on their annual 3-week holiday to Cornwall, and they've decided to book. They wanted a break because he'd just gone through this huge court case. They wanted a break, so they've chosen this far away remote village in Cornwall. To the degree when they came to the turning, and he only just saw the turning, he turned left, following his sat nav, and the sat nav goes blank. You know, everything. So it's like the land that time forgot. So they,
Like
you know.
the Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah, exactly that. And I had this idea that they're totally cut off. So there's no internet, there's no mobile phone signal. You know, he's a bit worried about this because he's wanted, hoping to keep in touch with his chambers. His wife is much more happier and thinking he's got to sort of relax. But
She's yeah.
it's when they get to the village and they're pulling in, and obviously they're thirsty and hungry. So they go to the pub, and this is when the sort of the tension starts, because when the landlord, you know, in his wonderful Cornish brogue, Wasson would be, you know, is asking, you know, what are you doing here, kind of thing. And he said, oh, we've rented a cottage. And he said, what cottage is that? And he's cleaning his glass, and he says, Pendle Cottage, and he stops. Oh, I didn't know they were letting that out. And folk around here don't like to talk about it. So there's something not right here. So, and it isn't, you know, it's quite early on, about another few pages, you learn that there's been this horrific murder 6 months earlier. And sort of read on.
I know it's a case of not giving too much away, but you know, people who've seen a read novels like The Fog and you know, and horrors like that, there's a lot of that that comes into to the mix of this story, and it fills you with in intrigue, but that sort of jitteriness, you know, you're just wondering what's around the next corner, and it's not like I'm excited to see it, it's like I daren't look.
That cottage, by the way, Pendle Cottage, was my grandparents' cottage in darkest Shropshire. My grandfather was a village blacksmith, and the cottages were black and white, and there were three together, and they dated back to 12 to the 12th, 13th century. They were really, really old. And there was the smithy was down the garden. But when I was growing up, we used to go there for Whitsun, you know, a couple of days of the school holidays. I just remember so well that the garden path that went along, that sycamore tree was there. The graveyard was the other side of that brick wall. To the left, there was the outside privy, which was in use at that time. To the right, there was the chicken coop. We used to go and feed, I don't know, there's probably a couple of dozen of chickens there. At that time, we used to use the pump. So I used to have to go and use the pump, which was over the road, and fill up the range.
Well,
So it wasn't quite as desolate as that, because obviously it had had the makeover, but the external part was my memories of my grandparents' cottage.
That's really interesting. It's interesting how you take those memories and you conjure something around them. So the outhouses. I mean, the readers, our listeners, will have to get the book and read it. But there's some very, very interesting experiences out in those outhouses and in the end of the garden. So we won't give too much away on that,
No,
but
no.
I just thought it just reminded me of almost like you cross a line and suddenly this place that you've entered to the rest of the world doesn't exist.
Yes,
There's
yeah.
no connection whatsoever,
That's
but
right.
to all intents and purposes, to you, it's part of the coastline,
Yes,
and
yeah.
with this family, they're just there on holiday, and yes. The wife is just thankful. Oh, no internet access. Oh,
Yeah.
dear me.
The kids aren't happy.
No, they're not happy, and Dad's not happy as well.
Yeah.
So, but it was just that you know, the build-up, the tension that you create in the build-up to the final conclusion. We'll kind of leave it there in the ethereal.
Yes. Thank you.
But yeah, but it's definitely well worth a read. So that leads me on to really the trilogy, which actually didn't remain a trilogy, but we'll mention that in a moment.
Yes.
But the trilogy, the Marsden family. Now, I love this because I've spent many of my working life working in and around Keighley.
Yes.
And the Marsden family set in Keighley during, or just prior to and during the First World War and then between the wars. But I found that fascinating because as I'm reading through, and again, it comes back to the research you do, I recognised things. I thought, I know that road.
Yes.
You know, and the way you describe things. And so I had a particular interest there. But what I was fascinated by, and yes, it's a historical thing, and it teaches you a lot about sort of historical things that happened during that period of our nation's history. But it was the interaction of the people and the lifestyle of the people,
yes,
and the expectations and the mindsets of people of those days. I mean, how did the concept of the Marsden family first come about?
I wanted to write a historical account. My knowledge of that part of English history wasn't high. I mean, much more familiar with the Second World War, and researched, you know, behind going up to the Second World War. But I didn't have as much knowledge of the First World War. And it came to me, this idea of, I wanted to concentrate on, I don't like using the term working class, but not the, there's been so much with the aristocracy, with Downton Abbey and other books, yeah, of the time. Lady Chatterley's Lover is a good one, you know,
yeah,
that was set in large houses and so on. I was more concerned with what was happening with, let's call them the normal person, the, you know, person in the street. And
yeah,
then I got the idea of, so, well, a baker would be a useful avenue. And it's through the baker I was able to channel the research I did. And I did a lot of research specifically,
yeah,
for this. The book starts the day before Franz Ferdinand gets assassinated. That's the 27th of June. So it's only a relatively, the first book is only a relatively short time span.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
understanding what was happening, that there's so many interesting aspects.
Yeah.
You know, Keighley had 52 mills at the time and a couple of foundries as well. And there was a
wow.
lot of industrial unrest. And
yeah,
at the time of the book, the month before, there was a big walkout, and they pretty well starved, the owners of the mills and the founders, they actually starved them to death.
Yeah.
You know, to come back to work. I said, starve them to come back to work. You know, they were selling bread by the ounce. That's what it
yeah.
was like.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so you've
yeah.
got this picture. The other thing was interesting. They had issues around water quality. And so the men, before they went to work, they would go to the pub. And that was where they would get their liquid intake. And,
yeah,
and that's why they became drunkenness, of course, which didn't help. So you've got this sort of scenario of what was happening at the time. But what I wanted to do was to look at the family, and suddenly you've got this very bullying, the master baker at the time.
Yeah.
And
yes.
He was not an easy person to live with, and he'd gone down with problems with his breathing, which was with the flour dust, and which was common
yeah.
in baking. So, you know, within the first chapter, we learn what happens to him and the impact that has on the family.
Yeah,
and I really took it from there and saying, well, how does it move? And I was doing it step by step, almost like a diary, what was happening. So we've got what was on at the cinema. Now, I had access to the Keighley News. So I was using microfiche of the Keith News of the time. So all that is accurate.
Wow.
So and I also had back copies of the Times, the London Times. So again, I was able to pick items of news that was happening and then incorporate those into the story.
Yeah, it's really fascinating how you see the Marsden family evolve from those early writings of them to coming up to the war, and then
Yes.
through the war, and the involvement of the daughters and their
Yes.
roles in it all, and the son, who actually one of the books focuses on Arthur.
Yes.
And and his experience out there in the trenches in the First World War, which were harrowing.
Again, that was all based on facts. And
Yeah.
Arthur was an interesting character. He was not an easy person to like,
Yeah.
but for me, he had a lot of integrity for all his muddiness.
Yeah.
He
Yeah.
had a lot of integrity. He joined the Labour Party. He was a great supporter of the strikers. He had that social connection, if you like. And I rather like that idea that what was happening to just those kind, that sounds awful, but the type of person that he was and the role that he played in society. Baking was an
Yeah.
important part of daily life.
Yeah. What you think about the connections you had with all the locals, because
Of
he gets to know the locals and so on.
course.
Then his involvement in like you said, the Labour Party, the unions,
Yes.
and I suppose the almost like civil unrest that they were experiencing as a result of the walkouts from the mills.
Well, there was a lot of issues around the civil unrest, because obviously it wasn't long before we had the Bolsheviks. And although I don't think it would be a case in England, it was still not beyond the realms of possibility. I know that's something the government was worried about at the time, but I think what was the telling point was the difference between the social environment leading up to the First World War to the social environment working up to the Second World War. And I've done talks comparing the two, because it's quite marked how the social changes in what was, what, 25 years had been quite significant. The first, it was about a month before war was declared, when newspapers were starting to pick up, there could be a possibility here. It should never have happened. The First World War was nonsense. It was a domino effect with certain blocks flexing muscles, and it became, it was almost by accident. We should not have fallen. I use that, sleepwalked into war. That's basically what happened. It never needed to happen.
You almost felt like when you look through the history books and so on, you almost feel like the was it the German Kaiser who just
Yes.
you almost felt like he just wanted a war. He was bored. He wanted to wear his uniform. And and he thought that's the way to go forward. But I mean, that's very simplistic form, but it felt a little bit like that. And with the assassination of Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo, and that
It was
domino
about
effect.
power. Yeah,
Yeah,
your
it
power was
was. Yeah.
involved. No,
Yeah.
it was just unfortunately, we entered into this pact with Belgium, and that's what brought us into the war. Because as soon as Germany invaded Belgium, as they did in the Second World War, of course, that brought they sieged Liège. That was one of the early battles in the First World
Right.
War. They actually sieged. There was a lot of locals were killed there.
I think when you read through the stories, it gives you quite a very sort of clear picture from the everyday person what life became like as a
Yes.
result of these external influences
Yes.
and what it felt like and how it affected people's lives individually. So that part's interesting, but just the way that you then kind of weave the story, and you tell us about a number of things, really, because you're addressing for example, you touch on, even though you don't mention it, but this is what you talk about, mental health. So
yes.
the PTSD and
yeah.
how that affected people returning from
yes.
war. But you also talk about, in a way, social injustice
yes.
and the way that the workers were being treated, hence why they all sort of walked out. But also the disparity between the haves and the haves not.
Yes.
And
yeah.
And what life was like for both.
Yes.
So it's really interesting from that point of view, but also to then weave this story in of this family and the various directions each member of the family takes.
Yes.
And we said it's a trilogy, but in actual fact, you did a fourth, didn't you? What happened
well,
to bring about that fourth?
Yeah, well, I got so many responses, like
yeah.
ones you're talking about now, you know, what happens to the family next? And
Yeah.
having finished Pendle Cottage, I felt okay to go back into history mode again. So I decided quite early on to take the family into the next generation. So we're seeing the run up to the Second World War. So it starts early January 1939. And
yeah.
again, this was things that I didn't know, which I thought I might have known, but I didn't. I didn't realise, for instance, how widespread or the issue of Ireland had become at that time. I did not know that the IRA was that active, and they did declare war on Britain in January the 15th. It was which was quite weird, you know. And,
yeah.
But it was an excuse to start a bombing campaign. I did not know that there was an Irish bombing campaign in 1939
wow.
until I started doing this research. And
yeah.
And it wasn't as bad as the 60s and 70s, but it wasn't good either. You know, there were fatalities. Obviously, you know, when I'm looking at the news and what was happening at the time, then quite clearly this was an important historical time, and I cover that in the book.
I thoroughly, all the books I've read of yours, I've thoroughly enjoyed them, and I would highly recommend those books to any listener. Tell us a little bit about you've had awards, you've had various accolades, you mentioned you know, the Kosovans down in
yes.
London. Tell us a little bit about what's happened as a result of the novels that you've written.
Well, I think obviously the big one was the Kosovan connection with Flying with Kites, and
yeah.
being invited down to the Kosovan embassy and talking to the Kosovan ambassador was a great experience. And then getting invited to the Houses of Parliament and also the British Museum to talk to a group of about 70 or 80 of the, you know, all dressed in their national costumes, and meeting the Albanian ambassador as well. They were just
yeah.
wonderful, wonderful people. That was an experience, a huge
yeah.
experience.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think that it actually taught me is I was very, very naive when I started writing. You know, I had a story and I told it as a story pretty well. What I didn't appreciate was the potential effect that it had on other people. You know, and you know, it you know, when you're using a vehicle of communication, which writing of course is, you think of it in one way. So I like to entertain people, I like to educate people, and like to intrigue people. And you know, so I put all those in the book to try and see if I can do that. What I don't think about is what the impact it can have on other people. And people are then telling me, hey, I felt this, or B, I felt that, whatever it might be. And people reacting in that way.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I mean, it's very gratifying that people are being moved in some respects from my writing. I'm not trying to change the world. As I say, I'm trying to educate and entertain mostly.
Yeah,
And people are picking those out.
I think what you've certainly done is you've appealed to the humanity in us. When you think about some of the subject matter, and you talk about Albania. I mean, you touch on Albania in your book, The Coat,
Oh, yes.
and the whole people trafficking, and yeah, raising awareness. And I've said to you, haven't I? I've said that. You remind me very much of the likes of Charles Dickens, because in his era, for our listeners' benefit, nobody was allowed to lobby government. It was
That's right.
illegal, and so the only way you could actually get your message out and to raise awareness of the plight of anything or anyone was to write a novel. And Charles Dickens wrote The Christmas Carol.
Yes.
He wrote Oliver Twist. And you think those two in themselves, they've become very famous and very popular, particularly at Christmas time. And yet they're tackling some real social issues
Yes.
that still exist in our society today. And that's exactly what you've done, Alan, in terms of
Thank you.
the novels you've written. You've really raised awareness of some of these ills that are happening globally, and they're still happening today. And so I for one thank you for that. And I'm sure as well that if like for example the Kosovo embassy feel gratitude for having sort of raised some of these issues and the plight of the Kosovan people, but all the people involved that you've sort of touched on in your novels. You've actually brought to light some of the real issues that we still need to tackle in our society.
Yeah,
So thank you
no
very much
question.
for that, Alan. And you've entertained us at the same time, which is wonderful. And I, for one, I'm sort of intrigued in terms of what more novels are going to come from you. But also at the same time, and I know you've been asked this before, and you've done some work around it, and that is, when are we going to see it on the big screen?
Well, I've written two screenplays, the Tinker and Flying with Kites. Writing screenplay is a very, very different process. It follows a very organized structure, and you have to follow this structure because that sort of there's a sort of an industry standard. So I had to sort of do an online course to learn how to do that. And I get feedback that says, "Oh, this will make a great film," and so on. For pretty well all the books, people have said that. And the Tinker, particularly, I think would do that. But my publisher is very keen that one day that we'll get a film out there. But main issue is always as finance. I've had people who are saying that this is producers. We like this. Have you got any money? And you're talking about probably minimum £500,000 these days, for a not very sophisticated film. As soon as you start bringing CGI and big locations, then you're talking about mega bucks.
I suppose like with most movies that have come to our big screens, and even dramas that they've come to our screens,
Yes.
it's the belief that somebody has in them
Yes.
that is then willing to part with a lot of money to sponsor this and support it until it's released.
Mean, the publisher is very keen to try and get the Marsden trilogy. As I said, make a great Sunday night film, drama series, and it would. It's a question of somebody having the confidence really to pick it up and starting production. But I mean, a TV company, they could do very well with that.
Well, let's hope that at some point in time, somebody hears this episode and says, "Do you know what? I've read Alan's novels, and I think we could do something. And it would be tremendous for us to
That would
see
be a
that in person."
dream, Phil. A
It would,
dream.
it would, and it would,
Yeah.
and I, for one, would be a great supporter of it because
Thank you.
I love the novels, but I just love the way I saw it straight away as I'm reading through how you interwove those societal issues, and cultural issues and environmental issues into your novels, and it makes for a gripping, sort of novel that sort of keeps you on the edge of your seat and wanting to pursue it right the way through to the end. And as I said to you earlier, you get to the end of a chapter and you're thinking, "I can't leave it there. I've got what happens next?" And I'm one of these. I'm terrible with series on
Yes,
TV because I wait till the series is out and then I'll just literally do a whole load
finish.
of I'll
I'm the
do a big
same.
binge.
That's right.
Alan, it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you, and
Thank you, Phil. Enjoyed it very much.
well, thank you. Thank you for your time, and thank you for the novels that you've written so far, and thank you for the ones that will yet to come.
I give you my the website address because I've
Please do, please do.
all of the books are there and you can read the first chapters. So anybody wanting to have a taster, they can do that. It doesn't cost anything. And there's links then into to the books where they can buy them. But it's www.alanreynoldsauthor.com.
Right, fairly straightforward.
Very straightforward.
And if anybody wants to sort of respond to you in any way, can they just use that same website? Just a
Yeah, you can email me direct.
right.
That would be the easiest. It's alan@alanreynoldsassociates.co.uk.
Right, Alan, that's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your
And
time and
no,
interest.
my pleasure, and I wish you all the best going forward.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Take care.